Up to Daf Gimel Amud Aleph. No, sorry. And we're 10 lines down from the top. And you'll see the first word of the line, again, if you have the same print that I have, is Ishto. And then it says Tana Debei Rav Yishmael. So that's what we're up to for today. Oh, how are you today, John? Tana Debei Rav Yishmael. Now the word Tana usually indicates a braisa. However, there's another word that's more common for a braisa, and that you have to add one letter. Which letter do I add? Excuse me. A yud. If I add a yud to Tana, what do I get? Tanya. Tanya is the classic word that introduces a braisa. Tana is really the verb, and braisa is the noun. So whenever you see the word Tana, it means that he taught in a braisa. This is what he wants to convey to us in a braisa. And again, if you're interested in the history of Rabbi Yishmael, I mean, Rabbi Yishmael was an unbelievable Tana. I mean, we can't even comprehend his influence on the transmission of Torah. And it also fascinates me that we call a Jew, a great Jew, by the name Yishmael. I mean, in the parashas that we've been reading, Yishmael is a little bit of a questionable personality. I mean, if I had to choose a biblical figure to name my son after, I'm not sure if my good buddy Yishmael would be first on my list.
But it's Rabbi Yishmael.
That's, well, you missed the first part of the Shia, Yaakov. We're learning the Torah of Rabbi Yishmael. And I was saying it's a little bit odd that his father gave him the name Yishmael.
Yeah.
Now the truth is that during much of Jewish history, the Ishmaelim were very good to the Jews. Today, I think we're suffering. Yeah, we're doing better with Esav today than we are with Yishmael. It's mind boggling.
Yishmael and Yishmael, is it? I know it's very, very close, but is it the same?
Yeah.
The contrast in.
I mean, not this Yishmael. Comes from good Jewish lineage.
Did he write the Exegetes, you know, the things what you do with the Gemara?
No, that I don't think.
Oh,
you mean the hermeneutic principles?
Yes.
Yeah.
We do every morning.
Yeah.
The Chumash on Yishmael says, Bayigba, Bayamas, Bayayosei, Bayamav.
So at the end of his days, he did Shuvah.
He did Shuvah. Okay, right. So. That was a designation that was
right.
Tzaddikim.
Correct.
In fact,
Yishmael has special schuyas because he had the bris milah at the age of 13.
Ah, right.
But Bnei Yishmael hadn't done the shuvah.
Yeah, that's true. All right.
Yeah.
So what does he teach us? Now, Rabosai, I want to give you an introduction to this next Gemara. Rabbi Yishmael is going to ask a question which honestly, I have to be honest about it. It's antithetical to everything we know. The very question and the premise that underlies this question is antithetical to everything we know about Torah. And he says the following. Mipnei ma hemina Torah eid echad besota. You remember that the Pasuk says, the eid ein la, that there was no witness to see the tumah, to see her implementing that immoral act with the suspected adulterer, implying that if there would have been one witness, then we would rely on one witness. And that is a premise that is accepted universally by everyone. You know, we had Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi, but there was never a debate about Tumah. Tumah, the Torah believes 1:8. Comes along Rabbi Yishmael, he strokes his beard, and he says, Mipnei ma omra Torah. What do you mean, Mipnei ma hemina Torah? What kind of a question is that? You have no right to ask such a question. I could ask you 1,000 questions about the law of the Torah. You'll never be able to know the answer. We believe, and that's the yesod of our faith, that the Torah is divine. We have no right to question the Torah. Chazal over and over again used the following phrase. I'll try to translate it into English. Kach gozra Torah, v'eilecha rishus lahar achreo. This was the decree of the Torah. Who's going to tell me why I blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah? No, I'll even ask you more. Why do I blow a shofar of a ram on Rosh Hashanah? Who's going to tell me why I don't eat chazer? So there was a theory back in the time of the Rambam that eating swine causes trigonosis. We've disproven that theory. Whenever you speculate about the reason for a mitzvah or a law in the Torah, you are treading on very dangerous ground. You have no right to speculate. You start speculating and you end up in apikoris, chas v'shalom. Tell me, is there anyone here in the room who's wearing a beautiful beged, which I can tell you where you get it, it's very expensive, that has both linen and wool in it? I don't see any volunteers.
Anyone?
No one's volunteering. You know why? Because the Torah says you're not allowed to wear such a beged. So, v'pnei ma omra Torah, sheshatn is awesome. Is that going to be Rabbi Shmuel's question? If that's Rabbi Shmuel's question, I'm ready to throw in the towel. Because we're not going to be able to answer 1,001 questions. The Rambam authored a book called Mora L'Nevuchim, and his purpose was to try to make the Torah palatable to the rank and file citizen. So he offers explanations for this mitzvah, for that mitzvah. The Rambam knew very well that none of these explanations could really satisfy the answer to the question why. There is no question why. We don't ask the question why. In fact, the Rambam himself, when he gets to Shofar, in Mishneh Torah, that's the halachic work in the Rambam says that Shofar is a gzeiras hamelech. It's the decree of the king. We don't question the king. You start asking mipnei ma, and I'll meet you in the apikoros club at the end of the day, because you'll never, ever answer the question mipnei ma. So this Rabbi Yishmael doesn't sit with me. But I'll tell you what I think the answer is. There is one kind of mipnei ma that's legitimate. And that is when you see a halacha which contravenes the halacha itself. Let me explain. If you want to ask the reason for a mitzvah or a Jewish law, that's posel trait. Don't even go down that way. But if you see that the Torah creates a certain framework, which is called ne'emanus. Ne'emanus means reliability, credibility. And then you get to a certain place in the Torah, and the Torah seems to contradict itself. How many witnesses do we need according to Torah law? The Torah itself tells us. You want to put someone to death? You want to accuse someone of a criminal act? You know, he violated the Shabbos. He ate nevela. Torah says you need two witnesses. In fact, if I want to claim you owe me $100, I gotta produce two witnesses. All of a sudden, we get to Sota, and we're talking about the guilt for the most hideous crime of Gili Arayis, of a woman having a relationship out of wedlock. And the Torah says we'll rely on one witness. How do we put that into some sort of a rational frame of reference? That's what Rabbi Shmuel is asking. And look at his answer. Beautiful answer. Sheraglayim l'davar. Now, literally, that means there are feet or legs to the matter. Now, that doesn't mean a thing to you. But legs mean something to stand on. What happened? First, this woman, as we'll see in Rabbi Akiva later on, was not really behaving so properly.
Rabbi, excuse me, where about time?
Oh, you weren't here when we started. So we made a point to get so that everyone should be on the same place. So it's 10 lines down from the top.
Okay.
You may see again, depending, I don't know, yesterday you showed me you have a different Gemara than I have, so I get very nervous.
Right.
But the first word in my line is Ishto. Do you have such a thing?
I see.
And then you'll see Tana Debe Rabbi Shmuel. Okay?
Just here.
Now, please underline the words Raglayim Ledover. Very important two words. It's an idiomatic phrase. There are legs to stand on. I would translate it as circumstantial evidence. To what extent and under what conditions does the halacha recognize circumstantial evidence? That's what Rabbi Shmuel is addressing. When do we say Raglayim L'davar? Where there's smoke, there's fire. Something smells rotten in Denmark. Number one, there was kinui. Why was there kinui? Why did the man say to his wife in front of two witnesses, don't go into a private place with Yankel Beryl? She wasn't behaving properly. Again, we're going to get to Rabbi Akiva.
She's a hussy.
I'll leave Rabbi Akiva actually for Rabbi Myers for a little, because we won't get to it today. But Rabbi Akiva says, you don't just give a woman kinui. Kinui has to be justified. There was circumstance, that's number one. Then what happened? Stira. She finds herself secluded with that man. As I say, das schmeckt nicht gut. Doesn't smell too good. But now we get to the clincher. One Jewish reliable witness says, I saw them do what you and I hope she didn't do. Torah says we don't rely usually on one witness, but after all, one witness, if he's a reliable fellow, is worth something. And I'll prove it to you. Now again, what I'm about to say might just blow you out of the, you might fall off your seat. So hold on to your seat. For Bnei Noach, for Noachide people, which is 99% of the people on the earth, we could condemn them to death, and according to Jewish law, they will be put to death if they violate any of the seven mitzvos of Bnei Noach in the presence of, can you see this finger? One witness.
Wow.
So you see, the Torah relies on one witness. In fact, if I come to claim that you owe me 1,000, if I can produce one witness, you'll have to take a shvua, an oath. Benikitas Chafetz, I don't want to describe the whole ritual, it's really scary, spooky, in order to contradict my one witness. And if you cannot take the shvua, you will pay. Why do you have to pay? Because I had one single witness. But now what happens? There was suspicion, then there was kinui. After kinui, she violated the kinui. There was stira. We have clear-cut evidence. Two witnesses testified that she went into the secluded room. And now, we have one witness who saw the tumah. That's called raglayim ledavar. And the Gemara is going to point out that this raglayim ledavar, this circumstantial evidence, is so powerful that in event that she cannot drink the mayim marorim, like bizman hazeh in our time, we assume that she had this immoral act and she could no longer resume her relationship with her husband. That's called raglayim ledavar. The Gemara Masechta Ksubis uses the svara of raglayim ledavar to ask the question, how was David able to marry Bathsheba? You may recall that Bathsheba was married to an individual by the name of Uriah Chiti, and David had a relationship with her. The law is that if you have a relationship with a married woman, you can never marry her. So the Gemara says, well, yeah. Nobody knew about it.
I thought he was divorced.
Nobody knew about it. So the Gemara answers, listen carefully, Raglayim Ledavar. Again, let me just give you the picture so you get the overall picture. What's Raglayim Ledavar? David HaMelech summoned Bathsheba into his palace. Nobody saw what happened, but there was Raglayim Ledavar. The Gemara uses the same logic with regard to Esther and Achashverosh. Nobody actually witnessed Esther having a relationship with Achashverosh. So when the Gemara wants to know, would Esther, at the end of the story of the Megillah, be able to resume her marriage with Mordechai? Again, I'm assuming 15 different assumptions, but let it go. So the Gemara says, but who saw Esther having a relationship with Achashverosh? Says the Gemara, Raglayim Ledavar. The man chose from all the maidens Esther. That's called Raglayim Ledavar. The Gemara has a case in Bava Kamma. You've got two animals standing one next to the other, yours and mine. Your animal is kicking up pebbles. My animal drops dead with pebble wounds in its back. So Gemara says, I can sue you for damages. Raglayim Ledavar. The halacha over and over again gives great significance and places a tremendous amount of weight to evidence, which is Raglayim Ledavar.
Overwhelming circumstantial evidence.
Exactly. Yeah, and the punchline, if you're ready for the punchline, this is Gemara in Makkos. Have you learned Makkos?
No.
When you finish Sota in about 3 years, at the rate we're going, ask Rabbi Meis to teach Makkos. It's an amazing Masechta, and it's only 22 blot. The Gemara in Makkos says, how could we ever put anyone to death for Gili Arayis? So Gemara says, what do you mean? There are two witnesses who saw the act of intercourse. So Gemara says, what did they see exactly? Did they actually see, pardon the expression, penetration? The Gemara says, Kiderech HaMenoachim. It's enough that the witnesses see that he's lying on top of her in a way that we can assume, etc. Raglayim Ludov. The Gemara says that we are not asking a philosophical question, why did the Torah say that one aid is believed in Tumah? We don't ask philosophical questions. That's the divine law. But the Gemara says, we have to derive halachic conclusions with tremendous ramifications in all of the Torah from this parasha of Sota. The fact that the Torah believes one aid introduces a breakthrough concept called what? Everybody, Raglayim Ludover. I need a choir here. 1, 2, 3. Raglayim Ludover. Because I'm telling you, Rabbi Osai, when you finish Masechta Sota, from my perspective, I don't care what you remember and what you don't remember. Again, your notes, hopefully you'll remember. But nobody here takes notes except for Yankala. Shkin. But if you took notes, theoretically, your notes, oh, you also take notes. Very good. Oh, maybe I had some impact here. I don't know. Well, maybe you took notes for my mind.
Unfair assumptions.
All right. But the only thing I want you, with my personal request, that you remember from Masechta Sota is Raglayim Ludov. Those two words. Because those two words, I can't tell you, will open up. Those are the keys that will open up so many locked doors throughout Shas. Raglayim Ludov.
Halacha is more central than American evidence, which does not accept circumstantial evidence.
I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in American law, but what I do remember that there are certain decisions that are left to the jury in American law that border on circumstantial evidence. Mm-hmm. Not only that, American law, whereas Jewish law will not rely on, can send certain things to the laboratory. I don't want to, you know what? I'm getting off on a tangent. Why is this Raglayim Ludover? Number one, Sharei Kino law, he gave a kinui. He warned them. Nistara, and she violated this warning. V'eid echad me'ida shehit me'a. And one witness testifies that she had this relationship, this intercourse relationship, in that secluded.
What happens when
this is what I call the sequence of events. Do you know what I mean by sequence of events? Sometimes the halacha says that if you look at the trees too carefully, you'll miss the forest. What? That wasn't a joke, Jacob. I meant that seriously. Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah.
The forest represents the sum total of an entire series of actions. When you integrate a bunch of actions together and you see the forest, the general picture. I like it. That's good background music.
Heavenly.
I think we should have it all the time.
What happens when you have one witness for trauma speaking, but you haven't had the first two stages? Worth nothing.
It's only kinui, stira, and eid tumah.
They wouldn't even be forced to drink and then find out if she's guilty or not.
No. The entire parasha of Sota is predicated on eidei kinui and eidei stira. We undermine the parasha in a case of eid tumah. If the third element was testified by one witness, forget about her drinking, she's assumed to be guilty. Now, what are the implications of assuming that she's guilty? We're going to get to that in just a minute, but for our purposes now, she doesn't drink from the Meimarim. She's not allowed to resume her relationship with her husband. We assume that she consummated that suspicion. And
the same for stira. You have to have kinu.
Correct. There's no stira without kinu. It's A plus B plus C. Do we have Omer Leirav Papa Labaya? You have such a thing? Yes, no, maybe? Okay. Yeah. This is really such a classic Gemara. For this, we have to open up a Chumash. Here's one Chumash. If somebody can open up to Parshas Naso, that's Bamidbar Parshas. I have another Chumash here. Please pass this around. And I'll give you this Chumash in a minute. I want to see it myself. Okay. So who remembers what page we were on?
That's on page 754 for me.
What is it?
754 for me.
754. Okay, give me a second. I want to open up to 754. Thank you so much, Alfred. You always come through in the corner.
Oh.
754. Okay. Now take a look at this. If you look at Pasuk Yud Gimel on page 754, it says, V'nistra v'hi nitma. Alright? Mm-hmm. Now, how do we know Nitma'ah? Nitma'ah means that she consummated this relationship with that other man. Because it says, V'ein Eidba. It means that there was no witness. But if there would have been one witness, then we would establish Tumah. Then take a look at Pasuk Yedalet. The very next Pasuk says, V'avar aleha ruach kina. V'kineh asishto. In a word, Kinui. Am I right? Do you see anything strange about the sequence of the psukim here? Kina has to come when?
Before
Stira and before Tumah. Mm-hmm. Why did the Torah place Tumah first? The whole sequence is out of order. Amalei Rav Popol Abaye, Vakik Siv Kinui. Isn't it so? Vaha, isn't it so? That when it says in the Torah, Ksiva Kinui, Basar. Anybody know what Basar means? Basar, with a tough, which is Aramaic, means afterwards. Afterwards. Like, for example, Graisa also is Basar, means after the Mishnah, right? So Basar means after Stira Vituma Hudiksiva. This is very strange. The Torah, again, let's look at it one more time. The Torah says Vinistra, which is Stira, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, and then V'nitma. And then, all of a sudden, in Pasuk Yud Dalet, the Torah goes backwards to Kinu. Mm. Something is fluky over here in the sequence of the Pesukim. And this was the very honest question that Rav Papa raised to Abaye.
It doesn't necessarily mean she was warned afterwards, though.
Ah. So this is a very important principle, John. And this means that if you take a look at Pasuk Yud Dalet, look at the word avar. Well, how does he translate that into English? It passed? What was he? Yeah. Let me see, number 14. Passed over him. What does that mean, it passed over him? Very strange kind of language. So let me ask you a question on both sides. What comes first, a mitzvah or a bracha? A bracha. Does anybody know how Chazal formulated that? It's a Gemara of Psachim. That's called Over Lasiyosan, which means that the bracha has to be before the Asiyah, before the actual mitzvah was done. The word Over may mean to go back in time to set up a sequence in which X has to happen before Y. So you're about to implement the mitzvah, and the Torah says, wait a minute, you need a bracha over Lasiyosan, before. So the Torah says, V'avar, what does it say? V'avar olav ruach kina v'kineis ishto. Why does the Torah use the word V'avar? And here we get into technical biblical Hebrew. That V'avar in technical biblical Hebrew means that something happened before. How do we know such a thing? Because otherwise, the Torah should have used a different word. Instead of the avar, it should have used the word kinui in a sequence before. So if you take a look, just one second, instead of the avar, no, we have to see. Let me get back to you.
Does it mean that one witness is believed in a situation where
No, no. What it means is that the kinui in front of two witnesses has to take place before the stira. So even though the pasuk of kinui is written sequentially in the Torah after stira and after tumah, nevertheless, since the Torah added the word v'avar, again, after, I owe you an answer to the question: what would have been a better word than v'avar? But the use of the term v'avar indicates that the kinui took place earlier, beforehand. So the Gemara right away asks the question, Ella me'ata. Wow, this is such a classic Talmudic phrase. Ella, but according to you, me'ata, now, meaning now according to what you've established, that the word vi'avar means something that already had happened earlier, then what do we do with the parsha of Bamidbar, Lamed Beis? Now what happens in Bamidbar, Lamed Beis? Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Bnei Gad u'Bnei Reuven that if you want to inherit the land on the eastern side of the Jordan, then you have to go chalutzim in front of the military campaign. What does chalutzim mean? They have to go before. In other words, you have the armies. We're about to cross the Jordan. Who's going to lead the armies into the land of Israel?
Yoshua.
And Yoshua has to be supplied, so to speak, with a military might, a force, that's going to go first. That's called Chalutzim. That's going to be made up of members of the following two tribes, Gad and Reuven, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe. I don't want to confuse you, right? So the Torah says, V'avar lochem kol chalutz. What does it mean? V'avar lochem kol chalutz. We'll translate this into English. And every armed man amongst you, meaning amongst these two shvatim of Reuven and Gad, will pass over the Jordan. Are we talking about something that's going to happen in the future or something that happened earlier? When Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, have they passed the Jordan?
No.
But you're telling me that the Avar means it already happened earlier. Like the Kinui of the Avar took place earlier, before the what? Before the Stira and before the Tumah.
Isn't this a different use of Avar?
Again, right now, all I know, Ira, is that it's the same four letters. V-Ava. Do you see that?
Yeah, no, but it's a different meaning.
Okay.
They literally passed over the Jordan. You have it.
But they hadn't yet passed over the Jordan. So right. So what does it mean, V-Ava?
V-Ava is a passive thing. Something passed him.
All right. And you know what, Ira? I'll tell you what. What time is it now? 10:05. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just read the Gemara's answer and let's see, Ira, if we can fill... I think we might be able to fit your answer into the Gemara's answer. The Gemara says the following. Now, I'm going to use one word here, which I think, Ira, you'll applaud, in order to explain the Gemara's answer, context. In other words, every word in the Bible has to be understood contextually. Hasam, let's look at the context of Reuven and Gad. The word v'avar has to be referring to something in the future. Why? Midechsiv, because the next pasuk says, v'nichbisha aretz, you'll conquer the land, with Hashem, in the presence of God, v'achar tashuvu, and afterwards you'll go back to the east of the Jordan. In other words, we're going to have to conquer the land. You, b'nei Gad, b'nei Reuven, will be the first at the head of the army, and you'll cross the Jordan, you'll conquer the land, and then you'll go back. Mashma, it seems that the word v'avar in this context, lahaba, is referring to something in the future. Elahacha, but here, hacha means here, in the case of Sota, isal kedaitach kirechsivi, if it enters into your mind, that's called a salkedaitach, otherwise known as a havamina. As it says, meaning that first there'll be tumah, and shall have had this relationship, and then he'll give a kinui. He says that's impossible. V'avar basar tuma ustira? Question mark. This is what you call a rhetorical question. Is it possible that v'avar means in the future, meaning after there was already stira and tuma? That makes no sense. Kinui lomali. If we already have testimony that she had this adulterous relationship, what's shaychus kinui? Kinui means to warn her that she shouldn't do X and go alone with the man. We've already established she had a relationship with this man. So the word v'avar now suffers or tolerates two different interpretations. Sometimes the word v'avar means in the future, and sometimes the v'avar goes back to the past.
The word avar means past.
Well, it means to pass over, but is it that it will pass over or it already has passed over?
It's avar.
So the Gemara is saying that the word v'avar means something that happened earlier. Mm-hmm. But it all depends on the context. If we're talking about something that's going to happen down the line, and the psukim, the verses indicate clearly that we're talking about something that will happen later on, then v'avar means it will happen in the future. But if v'avar makes no sense in its its chronological context, it couldn't be that he's warning her once she already had the tumah. Then the word v'avar tolerates a different meaning, that it had already happened, that the kinui had happened earlier. Tanu debei Rabbi Yishmael, another teaching from Rabbi Yishmael. Now here, we're going to get into a gigantic machlokas. Rabbi Yishmael says, "Ein adam mekanei li'ishto." A person should avoid, under all circumstances, if possible, kinui. Why? Because kinui, as we said, is very dangerous. The repercussions could be absolutely catastrophic to a marriage. Therefore, the only situation in which the halacha would allow or maybe even encourage kinui as elim kein nichnasa bo ruach, he's taken or inspired by a spirit.
Consume.
Now the Gemara is going to try to figure out what this spirit is. Is this like ruach hakodesh? Shenemar. Again, we go back to our same verse. V'avar alav ruach kinav kineas ishto. So the word here that we want to emphasize in this pasuk is which? Everybody? I'll read it again. V'avar alav ruach kinav kineas ishto. Which word do you want to emphasize now? Ruach. What is this ruach? Right? Rabbi Yishmael says, put all the emphasis on ruach. Because of this spirit, therefore, v'kineas ishto. My ruach. So what is this spirit? Rabbanan Amri, here we have a machlokes. The rabbis came to the conclusion, ruach tuma. There's something negative going on over here. In other words, some force of evil, let's call it a demon, which is called a ruach tuma, is influencing the husband to do something that's absolutely catastrophic. His jealousy is not justified. His jealousy is a result of a certain ruach. What kind of ruach? Ruach tuma. He should not have given kinui to his wife. And then Rav Ashi Omar, ruach tara. On the contrary, the spirit that inspired him to give his wife kinui and warn her was the spirit of tara. It wasn't the demon, it wasn't the satan, it wasn't the sitra achra, if you're familiar with any of those terms. It was the ruach of kedusha, of sanctity and purity. Umistabra, the Gemara says, it's logical to accept Rav Ashi in this machlokes, kiman the Omar, like the one who says ruach tara. And why? Disanya, because we were taught in a brisa, v'kinei es ishto rishus, divrei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael says you're allowed, you're permitted to give your wife a warning. Rabbi Akiva omer chova. Rabbi Akiva says, again, we'll see what the circumstances are, an obligation. It's a mitzvah to give kinui to your wife under certain circumstances. Rabbi Yishmael didn't want to go that far, but certainly the Torah would allow it. Amrit Bishlema, again a classic, Sota is full of all the classic structures of Shas. Amrit, if you'll say Bishlema, Bishlema means it makes sense. Ruach Tara, that what brought this person, the Ruach that the Torah refers to be Makani, his wife? It was Tara, it was the good guys, right? But who remembers, okay, I'm embarrassed to tell, who remembers Mad Magazine? Remember Spy versus Spy? Yeah. So which spy is it? The guy in the black thing or the guy in the white? Is it the good guy or the bad guy? So if you're going to tell me it's Ruach Tara, Shapir means it makes sense. Shapir means it's good, it's tasty, it's Gishmak. I'm very, very satisfied if you're going to tell me it's Ruach Tara, because then it makes sense that if you take Rabbi Shmuel, he's certainly allowed to do it, and if you go a step further, Rabbi Akiva encourages him, he's obligated to give her, according to Halacha, kinui. It must be that he was inspired by Ruach Tara. He's trying to get her to straighten her path and avoid any temptation. Eli Amrit Ruach Tuma, according to the first opinion that was quoted, that there's some demon here who's influencing him to bust up his marriage by giving a kinui, is then Rishus V'chova, whether you take Rabbi Shmuel's Rishus or Rabbi Akiva's Chova, whether it's permissible or even obligatory, is Liule Le'inish Ruach Tuma V'nafshe? Are you saying that the Torah is in favor of Iluye means to enter or to penetrate, le'inish, into his psyche, into his personality, a ruach tumah, to allow this ruach tumah to take over him, this impure demon, who's the sitra achra, he's the epitome personification of evil, he's the one who wants to trip you up, and now you're telling me it's a reshus, you should give in to all those feelings and emotions that brought you to in a state of jealousy, to warn her not to go into this room secluded with him. And now the Gemara wants to say, so what is the machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva? Let's assume we're talking about a Ruach Tara that brought him to Kinui. Why is it that Rabbi Shmuel says under that circumstance it's only what? A Rishus, he's allowed to give a Kinui. Rabbi Akiva went a step further and he said it's a Chova. So that's called Gufa. Gufa means, as you all know, I'm just repeating what you know, that whenever the Gemara wants to go back to something that was mentioned earlier and re-examine it, it uses the word Gufa. Let's go back to the Braisa that we had before that recorded a controversy between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva. And what is the text of that Braisa? V'kinas ishto reshus, divrei Rabbi Yishmael, for Rabbi Akiva Omer Chova, that when the Torah says that he warns his wife, according to Rabbi Shmuel, he has permission to do so, and Rabbi Akiva says he's obligated to do so. So the Gemara says the following. You know what? Let's add to this whole challenge another machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. It's interesting. Sometimes a good Jew answers a question with another question. If we don't understand this machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, let's introduce another machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, and then we can do a comparison. So now we're going to start with Rabbi Shmuel. Now where are we? We're now in Parshas Emor. And Parshas Emor, most of the parasha, for certainly the beginning of the parasha, is addressing the Kohen. The Kohanim are sanctified in such a way that they cannot contaminate themselves with Tumah. However, the parasha in Emor, for regular Kohen, I'm not talking about the Kohen Gadol, gives seven exceptions. And these are the seven close relatives. If they pass away, the Kohen is allowed to bury them, even though in burial he will contract tumah. Now let me ask you a question. I said to you that in Parshas Emor, the Torah permits the Kohen to bury his close relatives. So I use the word permission. Permission in the language of the Shas is called what?
Rishus.
Nay. He's obligated to bury the dead. It would be insensitive, it would be cruel if the Kohen lost his wife, Chas v'Shalom, and he didn't bury her. His desecration of his holiness, of his Kedushas Kehuna, is exactly what the Torah wants. In fact, the Yerushalmi tells us a story about one of the Amoraim, who when he passed by the what's it called with a B? I forget, a coffin, but there's another fancy word. Coffin. A bier? Yeah. Is that how you pronounce it?
Beer. Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to go touch it. So the rabbis pushed him.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you got to touch the bier of your wife. Because you have to participate in the sadness of this loss. Now, again, I'm assuming that a person is sad when he lost his wife. Because you told me yesterday that it's okay to tell stories. So the story goes.
Story or fairy tale?
I don't know if it's true or not, but this, I was raised on these funny stories. So my father told me the following. A man lost his wife. The Chevra Kadisha put her into a coffin. And in order to get from the city to the cemetery, they had to go over a bridge. As they're going over the bridge, one of the members of the Chevra Kadisha says, wait a minute, stop, I hear a noise. Sure enough, they open up the coffin and she's still alive. 10 years later she died, so the husband, when they got to the bridge, he said, please, go slowly. See, today you can't tell these stories, you get into deep trouble. Those are the kind of stories that I was raised on. So in any event, what is this deal with this Kohen? On the one hand, the Torah enjoins him from contaminating himself to Tumah. On the other hand, the Torah says that in 7 close relatives, he buries the dead. What does that mean? Permission or obligation? This is such a classical case, Rabosai. If you want to learn how to learn, this is where you should start. This distinction between permission, which is called Rishus, and obligation, which is called Chovah, will take you through the entire Shas, if you get it down pat. So Rabbi Yishmael comes first. And he says, when it says, La Yitama, he should contaminate himself to her. She's one of his close relatives, for example, his wife, his sister. Rishus! The Torah says, you, Mr. Cohen, are not violating any prohibition. You're allowed to bury her. Dibri Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Akiva Mechova. Rabbi Akiva said it would be insensitive and cruel if you wouldn't get personally involved. Your avelus, your grief and mourning expresses it itself in a very unique case of a Cohen in defiling his Kedushas Kuhuna. That's the paradox. The Torah wants the Cohen to become Tomei. So we begin to see a picture in front of our eyes. That just like in Kinui, Rabbi Shmuel was of the opinion that Kinui is a Rishus, the Torah allows it. Rabbi Akiva, that was Rabbi Shmuel I meant to say. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, the Torah obligates him in all the circumstances to be Makane. So too, when we get to the case of a Kohen, when he has an issue of contaminating himself for the burial of one of his close relatives, again, Rabbi Yishmael is very consistent. Rishus. The Torah allows it. We're not happy about it. But the Torah is going to look the other way. And Rabbi Akiva says, no. Chova, it's obligatory. A third case. Li'olam bahem ta'avodu. This is a pasuk, again, at the end of Sefer Vayikra, in Perchof Aleph. And the law is that if a person owns an Eved Knani, he's not allowed to free the Eved Knani. Why? Because the Torah says, Li'olam Bahem Ta'avod, which means that the Adon, the Jewish master, has to work the Eved Knani, and he's not allowed to free the Eved Knani. Anybody know what that's called, to free an Eved Knani? How you translate that into Lashon Kodesh? Shichrur, you should write it down. Shin Ches Vav Resh. like the war of independence back in 1947-48 was called Milchemet HaShichrur, which means to free us of those nations like the Brits who were sovereign rulers and subjugating us. So that's called Shichrur. Is the master of a Canaanite slave, of an Eved Canaani, allowed to free his Eved? So the Torah says, Li'olam Bohem Ta'avod. The word Li'olam means forever. Forever he should work his Eved. Divrei Rabbi Shmuel, I'm sorry, Rishus, Divrei Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says, you know what? The Torah's not happy with this situation where forever and ever and ever the master is going to enslave his Eved Knani, but if he wants to, Rishus. And Rabbi Akiva says, Chov. Rabbi Akiva says, if it says, Li'olam Bohem Ta'avod, you should always work your Eved. That is an obligation. You're not allowed to emancipate or free your Eved. So we now see a consistency in three different contexts in which Rabbi Shmuel always says Rishus, and Rabbi Akiva always says Chova. Amalei Rav Papa Abaye, again, once again a discussion between Rav Papa and Abaye. Amrile, there was another tradition that was Rav Masharshia who was speaking to Rava. Lema Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Akiva, b'chol haTorah kula hachi pligi. Lema means, shall we say? Lema usually introduces what's called a Hava Mina. That Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva consistently in Kol HaTorah Kula will always have the same argument, which means Demar Omar, Rabbi Shmuel will always maintain Rishus, Umar Omar Chova. So the Gemara says that, you know what? Abai says you'd be jumping the gun if you would assume that in every single case, in any context whatsoever, Rabbi Shmuel is always going to maintain the position of Rishus, and Rabbi Akiva consistently will always maintain Chova. Don't jump the gun. Amalei, Abai says in reply to Rabba, Hacha, here in our case, which is the case of Kinui, Bekroi pligi. They're not arguing based on some sort of, shall I say, Weltanschauung, you know, some sort of world view that always it's got to be Rabbi Shmuel Rishus, Rabbi Akiva Chova. But Bekroi pligi. Pligi means they're arguing. The word polig means to divide. There's a division of opinion. Pligi is the verb of the noun plugta. Cry means how to interpret the pasuk. So the Gemara says that if that be the case, if they're arguing over interpretations of verses in the Torah, then perhaps we can begin to understand all three machlokasin, all three disputes. In other words, the Gemara is going to go through the three cases that divided Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel and try to indicate that in each case they were arguing about the interpretation of the verse. Let's start with Sota. In the parasha of Sota, V'kine es ishto, Rabbi Shmuel says Rishus, Rabbi Akiva says Chova. My timer, de Rabbi Shmuel. Why does Rabbi Shmuel think that he has permission to give kinui, but it's up to his discretion, he's not obligated to do so? And the answer is because of a statement of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov was an earlier, older contemporary of Rabbi Shmuel. Desanya Savarle ki hai tana. He holds Savarle ki hai like this tana. Tisanya, we learned in the Braisa, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Klapei Sha'omra Torah. Why is it that in relationship, Klapei means in the relationship, in the background of what the Torah said, Lotisna Tzachicha Bilvavecha, you're not allowed to harbor hatred against your brother. Yachal, I might think, kigon zu. In this case, where a man gives his wife kinui, he's really jealous of the fact that she is hanging around with so and so, and then she goes ahead and she secludes herself with him, meaning she violates the kinui. Do you think now lotisnas achicha bilvavecha, that he, the husband, is doing something to violate the prohibition of hating his brother? Even in this case, there was kinui and there was stira. Talmud Lomar, the Torah wants to say that's not true. He's not violating lotisnas achicha bilvavecha. Why? Because it says in the pasuk Talmud Lomar, quote, v'avaral of ruach kina v'kineis ishto. So what is this ruach? It's a ruach of tara. It's a positive ruach. He has been inspired to set into motion through his kinui the entire sequence of sota. Why? Because he sees that she is not behaving properly. She, on a number of occasions, violates proper conduct, right? She's going into private places with a certain individual, and the husband now is inspired by a ruach of Tara, and the Torah says that ruach of Tara brings him and inspires him to give kinui. So again, if not for this pasuk of the avral of ruach means the spirit of Tara, then the impression would have been that we don't really want to allow this to go on, that the Torah is not happy about giving man a discretion and permission to give kinui. But the Torah adds the word ruach here, according to Rabbi Shmuel, to teach us that the ball is in your court, that the Torah says, you know what, I'm going to allow you to do this, and it's not a violation of lotisna sachicha bilvavecha. That's according to Rabbi Shmuel. So again, the way Rabbi Shmuel understands it, that if not for the word ruach, the Torah is absolutely opposed to kinui. But now the word ruach teaches us that since she was exhibiting an improper behavior, therefore, go ahead, it's up to you. Enjoy or take advantage of your discretion and give her kinui. The Torah says we're not happy about it, but we'll allow it because of these circumstances. And again, you'll see that Rabbi Shmuel is going to apply the same logic in the case of a Kohen. We're not happy about the fact that a Kohen is contaminating himself to the dead. We're not so happy about a person who works his Eved for the rest of the Eved's life without being compassionate and giving him a get shichur and freeing him. But the Torah nevertheless says, it's okay. We don't like it, but we'll look the other way and we'll give you permission. That's going to be the philosophy of Rabbi Shmuel consistently. But now we're up to Rabbi Akiva. Why is it that Rabbi Akiva holds that the logic of Rabbi Shmuel is to be rejected? And the answer is, because kinui achrina ksiv. Because we're going to find another mention in the Torah of the word kinui, and we're going to learn from that mention in the Torah of the word kinui, which the Gemara is going to analyze later on, that it's a mitzvah and it's an obligation. Okay, Rabosai, we're going to stop here. Again, we're almost finished with this sugya. I'm going to wish you all a great Shabbos and thank you so much for being with me for most of the week. And a Chodesh Tov to boot. In a few moments, almost, in a few hours, it'll be already the month of Kislev. And the message of Kislev is Kiddush Hashem. What a great sanctification of the name of God when these miracles that took place at the time of the Avonim, for which we commemorate Chanukah. So Yiratzon, may it be His will that we should see such great miracles and such great Kiddush Hashem in our time, like by Yomim Ahem Bizman Azeh, the time of the Chashmonoim, Kein Yiratzon.
Amen.
Thank you so much. It's still the end of Cheshvan, technically. I mean, again, there's a lot of lumpness here. How do we see 2 days of Rosh Chodesh? Is the first day of Rosh Chodesh really Kislev, or we have to wait for another couple hours? All right?
Is there a possibility, or am I way off the track of the book, that there's a process, there's a ruach coming in? You have been caused because he, it was
not my rabbi mind, so I'll go back
to that. He had actually witnessed something.
Right. He saw something, and Rabbi Akiva is going to interpret that what he
wasn't
saw.
Just that he sees the wife fooling around or mixing up with another man, but perhaps it was triggered because Ovar, in the past, it was more than just this fooling or mixing.
The other activities
maybe,
that were
maybe there was
inappropriate.
Maybe there was flirting.
Same was the westward?
Well, rather, there was Tumah. Maybe there was actually Tumah that he had witnessed.
Oh.
So he was.
We're assuming
motivated.
That, you know, in this context, Kinu came before Tumah. So it wasn't
that you were. I understand that, but I'm saying maybe he saw something